Thanks for joining us today on The Record. I'm Kim Malcolm. We've got lots of old, picturesque brick buildings in Seattle, and when the big one hits, you'll want to be far away from them. In a serious earthquake, bricks can fall on your head, the walls can buckle, and the floors can fall out from under you. Seattle has more than 1,000 of these buildings all over town. Seattle Times reporter Sandy Doughton found out where these buildings are and why they're still not safe. Her story in The Times is titled Buildings That Kill. Sandy Doughton, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So when you say buildings that kill, which local buildings would you point to?
Well, my colleague Daniel Gilbert and I found that these buildings are really all over town. They are the old brick buildings that you see down in Pioneer Square in the city's historic districts, but they're also very common up on Capitol Hill, these old apartment buildings, old churches, old schools. There's a huge concentration in the University District. There's a lot down in Ballard. They're even out in West Seattle, all over town.
So how could we make these buildings safer?
There are well-known methods for retrofitting brick buildings. And basically what they aim to do is kind of tie the floors to the walls so the walls won't collapse on people inside the building or people outside the building. And one of the simplest ways to do that is to just run metal rods through the floors and attach them to the walls. And when you see buildings with these rosettes, decorative rosettes on the front, that's often an indication that that has been done. You can do much more extensive retrofits with these big steel cross braces that you see in a lot of buildings around town, and that's a much higher level of upgrade.
So your report says that more than 1,000 buildings in Seattle are still dangerous, but they're not getting these seismic retrofits. Why not?
Well, it's a tough political problem, and it's an economic problem. Here in Seattle, we're facing a crisis of affordable housing, and these old brick buildings are often the most affordable places to live or to have a business in town. We also haven't had much political leadership. This hasn't been a priority for the city to make these buildings earthquake safe. It's expensive.
And talk a little bit more about the affordable housing piece. We're under a huge amount of pressure here in our city. What happens when you have maybe a dispute or a question about a particular building and someone has a new use for it, perhaps?
Well, if someone is going to significantly remodel a building or change the use, that's the only circumstance under which the city does require a full seismic retrofit. But in most cases, if it's an old apartment building, for example, and you just do internal remodeling to knock down some walls or, you know, add new appliances, that doesn't trigger the requirement for a retrofit.
Well, we're not the only state that has this kind of earthquake possibility facing us. California, Oregon, they have a similar issue, but they've done more to solve it. What exactly have they done?
Well, California is definitely the leader in this area. Almost 35 years ago, they adopted a state law requiring all cities to inventory their old brick buildings and to come up with a plan to reduce the danger. And most the vast majority of communities have complied with that. And so in cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, there are very few of these old unretrofitted brick buildings left. And in some California communities, on the ones that are left, they require that warning signs be posted.
And how about Oregon? What have they done?
Well, Oregon got a later start than Washington, particularly the city of Portland, but they have recently taken this on in a very serious way. They released an inventory last week, and they're on track to introduce an ordinance requiring seismic retrofits this summer. So it's likely that they're going to beat Seattle to the punch on that.
Has Washington State ever tried to address this problem?
Not on a statewide basis. I mean, there have been several state seismic safety commissions who have raised this as an issue. And it's not just an issue in Seattle, of course. All of our cities, Everett, Tacoma, Olympia, Bellingham, have these old brick buildings. And so it has been raised as a statewide issue, but not addressed as a statewide issue. Seattle is the only city that has actually pulled together a good inventory.
And why has the state not been able to get at it, even though it's had these different commissions?
You know, earthquakes are a tough problem politically and economically because they don't happen very often and they're so unpredictable. So it's conceivable that you require a building to be retrofitted and an earthquake doesn't happen for another 50 years, you know, beyond the life of the building. And so that's a tough political issue for politicians. In California, they have earthquakes more frequently. And I think that puts it on their radar screen more often than it is down here. But we can get much bigger earthquakes than California.
Do you see any potential fix in the works here?
Well, I think the city of Seattle just released a new inventory, and unlike the other eight inventories they did before this, this one is more validated, and it's more thorough.
How so? How more validated?
They've done a better job of investigating, you know, first of all, whether buildings really are unreinforced masonry. Sometimes they can just be a facade. So they looked at some of the records of the buildings. They went out, in some cases, examined the buildings themselves and, you know, compiled a record of previous retrofits. So it's a more thorough inventory. And that's a good sign. And they also sent notices to the owners of these buildings that there could be a requirement for retrofit. So we'll just have to see.
So in the meantime, what can people do?
You know, I think it's important to find out if you live in one of these buildings, and that has been difficult to do in the past. But now with this new list, that gives you a pretty good indication. And you can also find out what level of retrofit has been done on the building, if any. And then, you know, if you're a tenant, you're kind of helpless. There's not much you can do except to let the building owner know that this is a concern of yours.
Sandy Doughton, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sandy Doughton is a reporter for the Seattle Times. Daniel Gilbert was her co-author on the recent article, Buildings That Kill. It's the first in a special series called Seismic Neglect, the Earthquake Nightmare Public Officials Are Failing to Confront. Are you concerned about a brick building where you live or work? We're tweeting out a link to the addresses of these unreinforced masonry buildings right now. We're going to head back to the jungle now. That's the 3-mile-long homeless camp under I-5 in Seattle. Robert and Carmen Patterson are a couple who live there. Robert has been keeping an audio diary for us on his phone. He tells us about his life in his own words.
Sunday, Carmen and I try to make this our day, but we don't have to go anywhere. It's a lazy day because we don't have to go to either of our clinics. On Sundays, so we can just lay around and relax. Because to tell you the truth, being homeless ain't easy. We ain't lazy, not at all. We shower several times a week. We put on clean clothes every day because we do laundry. You know, we're on the methadone clinic, but, we've been clean 6 years almost now. You wouldn't have liked me if you didn't know me when I was on dope. I remember this one time I was in my sister's bedroom. I knew she had some pills that would make me feel better. And what did I do? I took the bottle of the pills and I walked away and I didn't give a And I haven't talked to my sister in 7 years now. What's wrong with me? Damn. You know, I don't make the bad decisions I used to. And one of the main reasons for that is because of Carmen, my wife. My beautiful wife, my best friend, my lover. I mean, if it wasn't for her, I couldn't imagine where I'd be right now. With me and Carmen together, we're a good team. Carmen had one of the biggest bros I've ever had. And she finally just got me around to her way of thinking. You're not the first person that's come and wanted to hear our story. Lots of people have. But you know what's happened? Nothing. We're still here. Still live under a freeway. And I was saying that. I'm not trying to
ask you for anything specifically. It just seems like I keep pounding my head on a wall. I'm not asking for much. A garage, four walls, a roof. There's electricity. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I really don't. Maybe even in the jungle, a dumpster. A dumpster so we could put our garbage in it. Well, they sent out more outreach workers. And when they came out, it was ridiculous. They asked you if you would like to go to a shelter. No is the answer. If I wanted to go to a shelter, I would be at a shelter. You know what I want to say to that? I want to say, how about you go spend one night at a shelter? I don't know what people think they are, but they're not cool. They don't let you in until about 8 o'clock at night, but you have to get in line hours earlier. And then they wake you up at like 4:45, 5 in the morning, and they're not nice about it. They're like, bang, 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 time to get up, go out and do stuff. I mean, it's 5 in the morning. What the hell are you supposed to do at 5 in the morning? I'm not bad. I've made some mistakes. I've hurt people. But man, it's still gotta live. Still gotta survive. I think our bus is coming. And I hope you could hear most of this, because I know the traffic's loud. Man, I hope you could hear it.
If you want to learn more about Robert Patterson's life in the jungle with Carmen, you can go to our website, kuow.org. He and some of his neighbors there have sent us photos and text messages. We want to know your thoughts. What has surprised you about the jungle? Call our feedback line at 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663. Voters in Oregon are going to the polls tomorrow to vote in their presidential primary. They'll also be voting on a bunch of state and local races. But truth be told, Oregonians aren't actually going to the polls. That's because just like us in Washington, voters in Oregon get their ballots through the mail, all 2.3 million of them. And as Salem correspondent Chris Lehman reports, Oregon made it even easier to vote this year when it became the first state to automatically register new voters when they get their driver's license.
In a special election in 1996, Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden became the first person ever elected to Congress exclusively through a vote-by-mail election. He remains a big fan of the system, which the state adopted for all elections in 2000. Wyden held a press conference this month at the Oregon Capitol in Salem to announce a bill that would expand the system nationwide.
We're interested in taking the Oregon way, vote-by-mail, into precincts all across America.
Wyden's proposal would require all federal elections to be held through the mail. States could still do as they please for state and local races. Wyden's tried expanding vote by mail before to no avail, but he says maybe this year will be different. Wyden points to reports of people standing in line for hours to cast ballots in presidential primaries.
Voting should not be a test of somebody's physical endurance. It should not be a Kafka-esque experience in defeating bureaucracy.
Oregon is now one of three states that vote entirely by mail. The others are Washington and Colorado. In another step to expand access to elections, Oregon this year became the first state to automatically register voters when they get their driver's license. Oregon Secretary of State Gene Atkins says since the law took effect in January,
we've registered 51,050 voters this way.
The automatic registration also happens when people renew their license or change their address. The system checks for factors such as citizenship status and age and whether you're already registered. If you're eligible, the state sends you a letter telling you you're now registered to vote in Oregon. You can opt out, of course. So far, just 6% of voters have done that. The newly registered voters are not assigned a party affiliation. They can choose one later if they want. So far, that's less than a quarter of them. Oregon's motor voter law has its opponents. During a lengthy floor debate, Republican State Representative Julie Parrish called it an invasion of privacy.
Democracy is also about choosing not to participate. And when we forget that and we opt people in, I really try to avoid yes votes on anything that takes away the choice from a citizen. And this bill does that.
One unanswered question: how many of these newly registered voters will go on to cast a ballot? Secretary of State Jean Atkins says her office will crunch the numbers after the primary. But at this point, she has no idea.
This is a place where we're pioneering. We don't have a lot of history to go on, either here in Oregon or elsewhere, since we were the first state to start to do this. And so everybody's watching and everybody's very interested.
The first real test may come in November. That's because Oregon's party primaries are closed, meaning most of the newly registered people will be able to vote in only a handful of nonpartisan races. Oregon's automatic voter registration law passed on a near party line vote. Since then, three other states have followed Oregon's lead: California, West Virginia, and Vermont. But Oregon's law is the only one that's gone into effect during this election cycle. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
This is The Record. I'm Kim Malcolm. The University of Washington and KUOW officials worked to keep the acquisition of public radio station KPLU secret. That's the finding of a recent Seattle Times report. The story says the deal was intentionally described in vague language on meeting agendas, and officials at the University of Washington and Pacific Lutheran University tried to keep details under wraps. Toby Nixon is with the Washington Coalition for Open Government. He says overall, when it comes to transparency, the University of Washington doesn't have a good track record.
They have this track record of having meetings that weren't easily accessible to the public, the evening before their regular regents meetings at the home of the president, which the location wasn't even disclosed on the meeting announcements. And then they had this very behind closed doors process used to select the new president of the university. And now, of course, we have this controversy over the acquisition of KPLU by KUOW. And I think that the cause of this is that they're acting more like a corporate board of directors than like the governing board of a public agency. And why would that be? Well, if you look at the composition of the Board of Regents, most of them come from a corporate governance background, not a public sector background. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, we often, especially conservatives, say we would like our agencies to be operated more like businesses. But it's a completely different culture in the corporate world than it is in the public world in terms of what are your reflexes? Are your reflexes to have things be open and transparent and engage the public in decision making so that we reach kind of a consensus? Or is your reflex to do things in secret because you don't want your competitors to find out about them? And so you wait until you do a formal public announcement before you ever bring something up. And I really see that clash of cultures demonstrated in the way the Board of Regents of the university operates.
Now, as far as you know, in this case, has the university broken any public disclosure laws?
Well, of course, there's technically legal, and then there's what's right and what's consistent with the spirit of the law. And I'm not seeing something that is a clear technical violation of the law, but they've clearly violated the spirit of the Open Public Meetings Act.
How do you know when an institution is acting in a correct spirit, a spirit of the law of public disclosure?
Well, the spirit of the Open Public Meetings Act is expressed in its preamble, and I'll just read it for you. The people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. The people in delegating authority do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. And I don't think there's any question that in this matter of the acquisition of KPLU by KUOW, it was largely kept in secret. They intended for the public not to know. And even if they may not have violated the letter of the law, they definitely were trying to decide for the people what was good for them to know.
The body that governs the University of Washington is not elected. It is appointed. So why does it matter if they function more like a corporate board in the private sector instead of a public one?
Well, they are a public agency. The University of Washington is an instrument of the government of the state of Washington. It was created by the people for a specific purpose. They get a lot of advantages, tax advantages amongst them, from being a public agency. And so we expect them to be accountable to the public. And if we don't have any idea what's going on until it's a done deal, then people are simply not going to have that trust that, things are being done in the public interest.
Toby Nixon is with the Washington Coalition for Open Government. Again, a recent Seattle Times report says the KPLU deal was deliberately kept secret during negotiations. Officials at Pacific Lutheran University were not available for comment this morning. The University of Washington's Associate Vice President, Norm Arkins, sent this statement in response. Quote, "We're a public university, and the public obviously has a right to know how we conduct ourselves. We take that responsibility seriously. With regard to some decisions, though, some of the work of necessity is done out of the public eye, negotiating real estate terms, admitting students, and selecting presidents. With regard to KPLU, we agreed to negotiate the terms of the proposed acquisition under a non-disclosure agreement with Pacific Lutheran University. Those negotiations took the better part of a year. At the point when they were ready to be presented to the regents, they were made public and continue to be public, which is how we got to where we are, waiting to see if the friends of KPLU are successful in raising the funds to purchase the station. And the record of those negotiations is part of the public record." Well, in the current digital economy, Seattle's faring pretty well. But if we want to succeed in the next digital economy, we've got some work to do. That's according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The business lobbying group recently ranked 25 U.S. cities on their readiness for what the chamber calls an extraordinary technological revolution. GeekWire editor Todd Bishop told Jeannie Yandel that Seattle was not that high on the list.
We're number 11, which was, I think, a little surprising to a number of people here in the tech industry. I think Seattle aspires, at least, to be number 2 behind Silicon Valley. And there are cities ahead of us, including Los Angeles, Austin, San Diego, Denver, and Philadelphia. You know, I've lived in Philadelphia, and I have a hard time seeing it as a more prepared tech hub than Seattle.
I think we should be clear that we're not talking about the tech economy as it currently exists. There are probably people listening to this thinking, are you kidding? Seattle is knocking it out of the park right now. We're actually talking about the next digital economy, the next tech economy. That's what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was looking at and saying, Seattle is not prepared for that next economy. What is that next economy?
Well, here's another place where I feel the report is just completely off base, because I would define that next wave of the economy as cloud computing, artificial intelligence, robotics, hardware, this whole idea that computers and personal assistants and agents are going to act on our behalf, that a lot of the very low-level things that we do every day, order groceries, pick up the kids from school, whatever it may be, are going to be taken over long-term by machines. And we've got that. We've got a fundamental base for that. We've got a fantastic artificial intelligence program at the University of Washington. We've got Paul Allen's Artificial Intelligence Institute. You know, it's very difficult to look at this report and take it seriously, honestly, and to have a long conversation about the merits of it, because the merits of it are pretty slim.
You just made a much better argument than I was about to make for why Seattle should have been higher in these rankings. So, I mean, what is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce even basing this on?
They essentially aggregated a bunch of research to create this overarching study. I know they talked with a lot of entrepreneurs. One thing they said is that although Seattle is doing well in a variety of sectors, no clear specialization has emerged yet, which was interesting because, again, I think if you talk to people here, they would say, well, no, cloud computing is the common thread that stitches together the entire community, everything from games to Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Azure. I mean, really, there is something that many people in the community have defined as the future, and that's it. So this report feels like it was written to me by somebody who's never been here. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but it has that feel as you're reading through it. It feels like they missed a lot of the thriving ecosystem that's actually here. And again, this is not to say that our tech economy is perfect. There are many ways that it can improve. But number 11 behind all of these other cities is a little bit hard to swallow.
I'm going to ask you a question that I think I already know the answer to, Todd. Do you agree with the Chamber of Commerce's assessment of Seattle?
There are some places where they did get it right. I mean, there are some times when entrepreneurs here can feel isolated. And I would also point to the fact that even though we do have that breadth of sectors, they don't always communicate with one another. So the internet startups are not always collaborating with the life sciences startups in a way that they could. So there are some hints of truth here. It's just the ranking that's so difficult to swallow.
Okay, well, it sounds like better communication, better collaboration between tech organizations here, that might be one way to improve the culture here in Seattle. What else can we do to make this a more perfect tech culture?
You know, the collaboration is a big thing. And really, I think it's looking at this report. I think actually reading this report and seeing what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is perceiving from afar is one way that the tech community could basically say, hey, where can we improve? And because external perception is huge, there are companies here that are trying to hire and they need to bring people here. And the perception of Seattle can play a role in that. If somebody comes here and wants to get hired by a tech company and does not think that the tech community is supportive of you know, them or their endeavors long term, then that is something that could prevent somebody from coming here. And of course, then you have the whole old versus new Seattle debate, where I think a lot of people who've been here for a number of years might not want those folks to come here and continue the boom.
Well, how do you think that tension is going to affect the tech community's desire to become better, to become more innovative?
If it starts to reach the point where when people interview here, so an engineer coming out of college from another region wanting to work for a Microsoft or an Amazon or a Facebook here in Seattle, and they hear from their friends, hey, you don't want to go to Seattle because the traffic is so bad, the housing costs are so high. In other words, their friends are basically saying it's another Silicon Valley in San Francisco. That's the point where it becomes a real problem. And I think that's the thing that we have to avoid. Some people might say we're very close to that state, if not already there. And it's a balance. It's a struggle. And the infrastructure needs to keep up.
I've asked you a lot of questions about this U.S. Chamber of Commerce study that puts Seattle in the middle when it comes to being prepared for the next tech economy. Why do you hate this study so much?
That's a good question. You know, I think that I would expect a study like this to reflect reality. And from the inside, at least, it's difficult to see it as a 100% authentic portrayal of the way it is to exist in Seattle. And again, I think that it's very, very important, and I don't mean to overshadow this. We as a community, as a tech community, have a lot of room to improve. And, you know, GeekWire as a site, we're here and we cover the technology world through the lens of Seattle in a lot of ways. And we don't we like to think that we're looking at it in a very clear-eyed way. And I don't think this study does that.
That's GeekWire editor Todd Bishop speaking to Jeannie Yandel. We're tweeting out a link to that study right now. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Kim Malcolm. In 1941, the federal government needed someone to sell farmers living near the Columbia River on a huge public works project, the Grand Coulee Dam. So they hired folk singer Woody Guthrie. He spent the whole month of May 1941 traveling around Washington and Oregon and writing songs for a government-made documentary about the river, the farmers, and how the dam would make life better.
On up the river at Grand Coulee Dam, mightiest thing ever built by a man, to run the great factors for old Uncle Sam. It's roll on, Columbia, roll on.
Greg Vandy is a DJ for KEXP. His new book chronicles the history and cultural impact of Guthrie's journey. The book is called 26 Songs in 30 Days, Woody Guthrie's Columbia River Songs and the Planned Promised Land in the Pacific Northwest. Vandy talked with Jeannie Yandel about what Guthrie's songs did for the government and what they did for people in this region. Starting with the song we've been hearing, Roll On Columbia.
Your power is turning our darkness to dawn. Roll on, Columbia, roll on.
Turning our darkness into dawn, which literally means, you know, using the Grand Coulee Dam as a way to generate hydroelectricity, which would literally bring electricity to rural people for the first time. I mean, if you can imagine people in the 1930s living out, you know, in rural areas and outside of the cities of the Northwest, they didn't have electricity. So, you know, imagine their lifestyle, you know, cooking on a wood stove and, you know, farming without electricity was a very hard life. So Woody really voiced the need for everyone that, yeah, you know, turning your darkness into dawn is a really beneficial thing, you know, in those days.
Aside from providing electricity for these rural people in eastern Washington and eastern Oregon, why was the Grand Coulee Dam such a life-changing thing for our region?
Well, you know, it really brought people into the modern world. You know, with there was really an experiment, really, in social democracy in a way. So it was a way in which, you know, the government could affect the life and, you know, the happiness of people in our regions by providing them with these benefits, which were hydroelectricity, newly irrigated land, which people could start over and become farmers in the Columbia Basin, and trying to create sort of a new democracy in which it was putting people first. And this idea of social democracy was something that was very attractive to Woody Guthrie.
The book that you wrote about this project is called 26 Songs in 30 Days. So that tells us something about what Woody Guthrie did when he was out here in the Columbia River Basin. He wrote nearly a song a day. But what else was he doing when he was out here?
Woody toured the Columbia Basin with a driver named Elmer Bueller. And so he was able to sort of see the land and be inspired by the projects.
I'm just a stranger traveling through your land. You need a right good worker on your big Grand Coulee Dam.
And then we'd go back to Portland and write the songs in the BPA office there on Oregon Street. And Stephen Kahn, the director, you know, held him to this sort of idea of a song a day. Kahn's theory was, like, when he was working in Hollywood with screenwriters, they had to turn in 3 pages of stuff, whether it was good or bad or whatever. And so he held Woody to that same sort of requirement.
What impact did the songs that Woody Guthrie wrote about the Grand Coulee Dam, what impact did they have on the American public?
Yeah, well, the songs didn't really have an immediate impact because the film never got made and wasn't really completed until 1949. The war interrupted the production, and it eventually got made. But by that time, Woody had already recorded the best songs of these Columbia River songs for Moash in New York City for Folkways in the mid-1940s. So a lot of the versions that we know, like Hard Traveling and Talking Columbia Blues.
Way down the road, cutting out wheat and stacking out hay and trying to make about $1 a day, and I've been having some hard traveling, Lord.
These are songs that Woody recorded after the Portland experience, and then these songs eventually sort of found their way to other singers and other revivalists really in the late 50s and in the early 60s. So Woody really, he really became sort of the legend that we know. He was really more of this kind of father figure, the silent father figure to a lot of the folk revivalists of the 1960s.
Woody Guthrie grew up in Oklahoma. He was one of the refugees from the Dust Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the farmers who had to leave the Dust Bowl saw the Columbia River Basin as kind of a promised land. How did the songs that Woody Guthrie wrote about the Columbia River Basin speak to that?
After irrigation, this dry area, this unusable land, would become usable. And as you see it today, is really one of the breadbaskets of the region is the Columbia Basin. That's because of the water diverted at the Grand Coulee Dam site down into the Columbia Basin. So the idea was literally at the time of the 1930s, it was to sort of relocate people who were homeless and who were migrants and have them move to the Northwest to start their lives over again. So the Columbia Basin was really sort of an answer to the Dust Bowl crisis. You know, that was the sort of idea. And so Woody, of course, was really sort of rallied behind that idea and was really inspired to write these songs to express that idea.
Is there a song that springs to mind that reflects some of those ideas about migrants from the Dust Bowl finding a new place to live and work?
Yeah, exactly. The song Pastures of Plenty is all about that.
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hand is hold.
You know, the hard life of migrants who left the Dust Bowl and, you know, found disappointment and corruption in the California experience.
Out of your Dust Bowl and westward we rolled, and your desert was hot and your mountains was cold.
The idea of the Columbia Basin irrigated to create this sort of promised land for people to go start their lives over again was very appealing to Woody in that song.
I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground in the light of your moon.
Woody's famous for all of the Dust Bowl ballads, and I find that the Columbia River songs are optimistic answers or solutions to his earlier documents of the Dust Bowl, and Pastures of Plenty fits that perfectly. You know, it talks about the struggles of migrants, and that the waters of the Columbia River and the irrigation of the Columbia Basin would create a pasture of plenty.
Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that Grand Coulee Dam where the water runs down.
So literally, Eastern Washington, the Columbia Basin, is the pastures of plenty.
We talked about what the Bonneville Power Administration, what the federal government wanted the Columbia River Basin to represent for refugees from the Dust Bowl. What do you think this opportunity to write these songs represented for Woody Guthrie?
Yeah, well, he was needing a job, right? So just like everyone else during the Depression, Woody needed a gig. And so this was a great opportunity because he was really, as we describe it in the book, going through a winter of discontent in early 1941. And so the idea of getting paid to be a songwriter was very appealing to him. It also was an opportunity for him to do sort of patriotic thing. He was really attracted to the idea that it was not only just a songwriting gig, but something that he actually believed in because it was really a project that would benefit his people, And so the idea of working for the government in this capacity was really a patriotic effort in his mind.
At the time when Woody Guthrie wrote these songs in 1941, they didn't have a lot of impact on the American public. In fact, they weren't even really heard until years later in some cases. But why do you like these songs that Woody Guthrie wrote about the Columbia River Basin so much? What do they say to you?
Well, they're about us. These songs are about our region. And Woody, there's a famous quote that we use in the book where Woody says, when someone recognizes the place you've been to or the street you live on or the neighborhood you grew up in, there's a certain kind of quiet pride that sort of builds up inside of you. And that's really what these songs are about for me. And I think for a lot of Northwesterners is that these songs are about our region. And Woody and some of these songs, they're sort of love letters to the area. The descriptions of the pristine Columbia Gorge in 1941.
She heads up the Canadian Rockies where the rippling waters glide, comes a rumbling down the canyon to meet that salted tide of the wide Pacific Ocean where the sun sets in the west and the big Grand Coulee country in the land I love the best.
That's something that is, I think, is fantastic. And we wrote the book, me and my co-writer Dan Pearson, to sort of, let people know, it's interesting that a lot of folks don't know these songs really relate to them, but they do.
Dream of the day the Coulee Dam would cross that wild and wasted stream. Uncle Sam took up the challenge in the year of 33 for the farmer and the factory and all of you and me. He said, roll along Columbia, you can ramble to the sea, but a river while you're rambling, you can do some work for me.
Greg Vandy, he's the host of The Roadhouse on KEXP. His book is called 26 Songs in 30 Days. Vandy talked with KOW's Jeannie Yandel. If you'd like to hear more of Woody Guthrie's music, we're tweeting about a tribute concert at Benaroya Hall. That's happening on May 26th. And there'll also be a free concert and laser show Saturday, May 28th at the Grand Coulee Dam in northeastern Washington. This has been The Record on KUOW. Thanks for joining us today. News headlines are coming up.
Well, she tore their boats to splinters, but she gave men dreams to dream of the day the Coulee Dam would cross that wild and wasted stream.